Have you ever thought about exiles being missionaries? Hello, welcome to Good Word. I'm Dave Thomas, your host. We're continuing in our discussions from week to week of the missionary theme as it's found in the Bible and in Christianity. And this week our lesson is talking about the exiles who went from Judah, from Jerusalem into Babylon. And perhaps here I might just make mention of a little history that when God brought Israel out of Egypt, he made a covenant with them that had a long list of blessings and curses. And the blessings were a recitation of all the good things that would come to them if they were faithful to the covenant. And the list of curses, which happens to be longer than the list of blessings, is a recitation of all the ill will and misfortune that would come to them if they breached the covenant. And if you look at that covenant as it is laid out, particularly in Deuteronomy 28, you will find that when you get down to the end of the list of curses, there's a statement there about you will go into exile. And if you go even further down that list, you will find that one of the last curses is that they would go back to Egypt in ships, and they would offer themselves as slaves, and nobody would buy them. And that represents, of course, a complete reversal or nullification of the Exodus experience. But here, by the time you get into the 500 BC, 580 or 600 BC's late 600s, and remember, we're counting down, so we're talking about the low 600s to high 500s, that Judah has become idolatrous, and there are a number of prophets, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, several other smaller prophets who are announcing to them that their wickedness has come up before the Lord and they're going to go into captivity. And lo and behold, the Babylonians come and overrun them. And in 605 BC, the princes and are taken captive, Daniel being one of them. Then in 586, they come again and take another group. And then, 597, and in 586 BC, the Babylonians come back angrily and they destroy everything, including Solomon's temple. Everything is destroyed. And you have all these people taken into exile. And so, Paul and Brant, you are the conversation partners here again today, and I thank you for participating. But what can we say about the missional activities of the exiles? You have Ezekiel in exile, you have Daniel in exile. Any stories that you want to pull in there that might have missional capacity or intent?
Well, I think one of the statements of the prophet Jeremiah is fascinating. In Jeremiah 29, verses 4 through 9, God tells Israel through the prophet, when you're in exile, pray for their success, because as they're successful, as they prosper, you will prosper. And so he sends them into a foreign nation, and they're not to maybe take a lesson from Jonah. They're not to hope for the downfall of the nation, but to pray for its success, because maybe the message of their God will have a place to take root as well.
Mm-hmm. Any stories strike you, Paul?
Well, Daniel, I mean, the story of Daniel, which we've already mentioned, and obviously Daniel and his three friends become.
But is that a missional story, Daniel and his three friends?
Oh, now I'm wondering why. Am I missing something? I would say absolutely it would be
but
a missional
it's
story.
It's very dramatic, though. Missionaries are usually quiet, aren't they? I mean, you have a showdown on the plain of Dura that's of enormous proportion.
But again, it's not instigated by Daniel or his three friends. They're simply trying to be faithful in a foreign land, and that does lead to conflict, certainly. But they don't come across to me, at least, as flamboyant kinds of
attention. I wasn't suggesting they were flamboyant. I'm just saying that the event itself is rather spectacular.
Yeah.
To me, the most powerful.
All the best stories are mission stories. So,
couldn't the three men have chosen these young Hebrew men? Couldn't they have chosen to do something that caused them to stand out a little less? Couldn't they, Paul? I mean, isn't there
like dropped something on the ground right at the moment?
Needed to tie their shoelace.
Yeah. I suppose they could have.
But to me, the most remarkable and the most riveting section of that story is when the king offers them a second chance to bow down. And what do they say? I mean, those words burn their way into the historical record.
Yeah, I'm not sure what part of that you're thinking of, but to me, the idea we serve a God that is able to deliver us, whether he does or not. We don't know if he will deliver us. He can. Even if he doesn't deliver us, we're not going to bow to any God but him.
To me, I was thinking of the part just before that where they say, look, we don't need a second chance.
Yeah.
We're not going to change anything. We have stood here based on issues of conscience and conviction, and you can give us 10 chances. You're not going to change anything.
Yeah.
And then that confession is a very powerful one. Yeah. And I, you know, with all these stories in Daniel, whether it be the lion's den, and I want to come to that one in a little bit here, or the one, the golden image, I want to see the king's reactions to the final piece of the story. You know, with this one, it's he throws him into the fire, and somebody announces. And by the way, it's astonishing how hot that is, because the soldiers who throw the Hebrew young men in there die from the heat. And then somebody announces. I mean, you see the king dusting off his hands and saying, "Yeah, you know, you messed with me. That's what you get. You're done." And then somebody announces to him, "Oh my word! There are four people in there." And
the king. This is. I think there's a lot of humor in the story.
Yeah, I think so.
Because he asks his wise men, "Weren't there three men that we threw into the fire?" And it's basically the first time in Daniel when the wise men are able to provide an answer. They can't interpret the dream. They can't. But here they. Oh yes, there were three. But it's still the wrong answer, because now there are four. Anyway, there's some.
That is
great
funny, Paul.
That
is
the funny. Story.
That is funny. You were going to say something.
In each of these stories, the what we might call the narrative sections of Daniel here, the king comes to an understanding of God. But it's interesting to note how the king, and it's not always the same king. We have Nebuchadnezzar and we have Darius. They come to a fuller understanding of the God of Israel when Nebuchadnezzar recognizes that there is a God in heaven who can deliver, unlike his own gods.
Yeah.
He says that the God of heaven is worthy of worship. He doesn't do away with his own gods. Yeah, it's not exclusive, but the God of Israel is worthy of a look.
Yeah, but it seems like he's just pulling him into his pantheon of gods. He hasn't come to the point. It's a little later on, I think, that he actually comes to understand that the God of the Hebrews is of a different sort, not
it's
just
true.
Of course, Daniel comes to prominence in the first chapter, doesn't he? As a young man, where he refuses to eat the food that he's conscience-driven not to eat. And there again, you don't have as dramatic a scene, but it's remarkable how, and this is true in all those stories, that when these people stand for what they understand to be right, they open a way for God to act for them. See? And I want to bridge the story of the lion's den, because that's now in another empire. One empire has gone, Babylon is gone, and the Medes and the Persians are in. And here still this man, Daniel, continues. By now he's a very old man, probably in his 90s or 80s anyway. And he's set up by people who don't like him. That's kind of an unhappy story. And of course they are delighted because the king is put in a bind. Nebuchadnezzar would never have been put in a bind, because history seems to indicate he was a complete autocrat. He could have changed whatever he wanted. But the king of the Medes and the Persians had some laws. And so Daniel is thrown into a lion's den. And I don't know, you have any reflections on that story?
I like Daniel's stance. Much like his friends stood up on the plain of Dura, he didn't have to pray facing Jerusalem with an open window. He could have gone into his quiet closet.
Yeah, by the way, that's a very interesting point. I mean, that could have been an accommodation that would be completely justifiable.
Sure. But he had a tradition, and that tradition he didn't violate because of the circumstances might have made him think less of his tradition.
Or may have caused people to think that he no longer prayed,
Sure.
Yeah.
Isn't it more about the staying faithful to his conscience than the specific requirement that everyone must always open the window and face towards? That's not the point of the story, I don't think, but that, like you said, he's what he has always done. His relationship with God is such that it takes priority, and people trying to strong arm him into something else is
but
not going to have much effect.
But he also knows that people are watching the practice of his faith. And so he gets thrown in. My favorite part of that story is the next day, when it says that the king goes out to the the lion's den. And I am fascinated by that, because why would the king go out having thrown this guy into the den of hungry lions? Why would he go out there?
There must have been the stories, or there's something about Daniel that he's not convinced that that Daniel is dead. There's still some hope there. Yeah.
And I mean, from a human perspective, that is a long shot, Paul. Yeah. That is a long shot.
Yep.
And then my the piece of video I want to watch is when he calls down into the den, you know, "Oh, Daniel, are you still alive?" kind of a thing. And I want to see the moment where a voice comes back.
Yeah.
A voice comes back. It was a pretty bad day for the people who tricked Daniel.
But his question, King Darius's question, is interesting as well. The king speaks and asks him, "Has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" And there's maybe an already budding sense of faith in Darius.
Yeah. So what does this tell us about mission?
I'll go back to the earlier story of the fiery furnace, and maybe make a connection also with, if I have time, with the Great Commission in the New Testament. But I think their faithfulness, their willingness to stand, gets them thrown into the fiery furnace. And then it is in the fiery furnace that they have this experience of meeting one who the text says from outside, they say, "Well, there's a fourth one that looks like a son of the gods. There's some kind of divine being there." I think that we will most closely sense the presence of God when we walk in faithfulness to Him, regardless of what happens. And even in our times of trial, it may be in those trials that we will most clearly be able to experience that presence of divinity. And just to connect with the Great Commission, it's the promise of Jesus. He sends His disciples out, and then the promise, "I am with you always." So as we are faithful, Jesus is with us in those experiences.
Yeah, and I think it's by being faithful that we open the avenue for God to act in our behalf. If those guys had not been faithful, there would have been no occasion.
Right.
And it's by the faithfulness of God that this missional witness occurred.
Mm-hmm. In spite of the fact they were there against their will,
yes.
And sometimes things happen in our life that we can't plan, and God can still work very good things from it.
So. I remember a quotation from my youth that I read once in a while about people being willing to stand for the right though the heavens fall. And I don't hear much about that anymore. And I marvel at these young men whose convictions were so strong that they were willing to face death believing that God would work in their behalf. And because of that, the witness they give is not only incontrovertible, it's extremely powerful. Extremely powerful. So, well, Paul and Brandt, thank you again for your reflections. It's interesting to think about these exiles and in the midst of difficulty being faithful to God. My thanks also to David Olson, who is our engineer. And my thanks to those of you who listen to Good Word. For Good Word, I'm Dave Thomas.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.